The World War II years will forever be testimony to America's collective and individual resistance to tyranny, its awesome and ingenious industrial machinery, and what may be its greatest strength, the common values of its richly varied population when faced with a common threat. However, any celebration of America's strengths and qualities during those years of courage and sacrifice will be tempered by the stains of racism that were pervasive in practice and in policy. As it was an era of great glory for America and its people, it was also indisputably a time of shame. One does not cancel out the other, but any accounting of the war years is incomplete without the stories of those who were serving their country while fighting to protect their individual rights and dignity. What they experienced would be shocking enough if it were simply the work of a few misguided bigots, but the most shameful acts of discrimination and oppression were officially sanctioned by the highest officials of the land. Black Americans were called Negroes, or colored in polite company and official documents, but the hateful epithet nigger was a common expression, even when referring to black Americans in uniform. They had few champions of racial equality outside their own ranks. Eleanor Roosevelt spoke up for them, but her husband, the president, the great champion of the common man, was mostly quiet on the subject. Japanese Americans were subjected to even greater discrimination during the war. Their fundamental rights were swept aside in a campaign organized by some of the most distinguished figures in public life. The relocation of Japanese American citizens from their homes and businesses on the West Coast was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in the name of military security. In a contemporary review of that decision, the current Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, concludes that civil liberties are not expected to have the same standing in wartime as they do in peacetime, but he does believe the courts in the future will review more carefully the government's arguments for curtailing fundamental rights. Past practices and court decisions aside, the most compelling arguments against the wartime racism and official acts canceling civil liberties can be found in the lives and attitudes of the people who were the victims of those shameful episodes. Johnny Holmes was born in Ohio in 1921, but his family moved to the Chicago area after a few years because there was an opportunity. An aunt was involved in the Al Capone bootlegging empire, and Johnny's father could get a job as a driver and delivery man. They settled in the suburbs, in Evanston, home of Northwestern University, and life was good. His father had steady work, and Johnny, one of the few black students in Evanston High School, has no memory of any early racial discrimination. At an early age, he did become enthralled with the military way of life. For a time, he even considered joining the French Foreign Legion. So, by the time the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor, it had a ready volunteer in Johnny Holmes, even though the U.S. military was hardly friendly territory for black Americans. It's not that black Americans were not represented numerically. 1,200,000 were in uniform during the war, almost 10% of America's black population at the time. However, most were confined to the service areas of the military. They were ship stewards, or worked in the quartermaster corps, or served as drivers for transportation outfits. Only 10% saw combat. Those that did had distinguished records, but the myths remained. The military establishment was reluctant to acknowledge black Americans were fully capable of taking their place in the front of the ranks. Holmes was blissfully unaware of what awaited him. As he put it, "I went into the Army to become a man. I told my mama, I'm not going to let it break me, I'm going to let it make me." He began his military career at Fort Custer in Michigan, but it wasn't until he shipped out to Fort Knox, Kentucky, that he encountered real, bitter, racial hatred and segregation for the first time. All of the non-commissioned officers were white Southerners, as Holmes remembers it, and they made the trials of basic training all the more difficult for the all-black outfits. Among other indignities, Holmes is persuaded that Fort Knox dentists experimented on the black soldiers. He remembers being strapped into a dentist chair and getting his teeth drilled with no Novocaine. At the end of basic training, Holmes was sent on to Fort Claiborne, Louisiana, to begin his training as a tanker. By now, Holmes and the other black soldiers had weekend passes, But even though they wore the uniform of the United States Army, and even though they were prepared to give their lives in defense of their country and for the cause of freedom and against the fascist juggernaut rolling across Europe, the racial wounds at home deepened. Whenever they accidentally strayed into an all-white neighborhood, they were met with anger and derision. When a black soldier friend of Holmes was found dead on railroad tracks near an all-white neighborhood in Alexander, the other black soldiers were not fooled by the official story that he'd gotten drunk, stumbled onto the tracks, and had been run over by a train. They were sure he'd been beaten to death, and they were furious. They were by now combat-trained, and they were prepared to go to war against Alexander. They rounded up their tanks, machine guns, and grenades, but their commanding officer reasoned with them, and they backed off. Wasn't long, however, before there was another racial flare-up, this one at the PX. A black soldier was cheated at the cash register by a white clerk. When the soldier protested, racial slurs started flying, and again, the Louisiana base was at a racial flashpoint. Holmes recalls with pride that not long after that, the PX staff was integrated. If anything, life as a black soldier became even more intolerable when Johnny Holmes and his units transferred to Fort Hood, Texas, to begin the final phase of their preparation as an armored unit. Fort Hood was also home to a stockade full of German prisoners of war. It is one of the little-remembered curiosities of World War II that German and Italian prisoners were often shipped to remote places in the American West to await the end of the war with more comforts than they would have had at home. Johnny Holmes remembers, however. He remembers the German POWs were allowed to go to the PX when Holmes and his friends could not. He remembers white officers saying, "If you boys don't behave, we'll have those Germans guard you." What he remembers most of all was an incident involving his platoon lieutenant, a recent graduate of UCLA where he starred in three sports. His name was Jackie Robinson. One weekend, Holmes, Robinson, and some of their friends went to Temple, Texas on a weekend pass. They weren't in town long before Holmes felt a piercing pain in his chest. He didn't know it at the time, but it was pleurisy, an inflammation of the muscles that can be debilitating. He could barely walk. Lieutenant Robinson helped his young soldier on a bus headed back to the base, stretching him across the front row of bus seats. The white driver would have none of it, telling Robinson to get Holmes to the back of the bus and get there himself. As Holmes remembers it, Robinson said no, he would not move Holmes to the back of the bus, and he sure wasn't going there himself. They were arrested by MPs back of the base, in Holmes' memory. In many other accounts of his life, the Jackie Robinson incident involved a light-skinned black woman who was the wife of a fellow officer. When Robinson was told by the bus driver to stop talking to her and move back, Robinson refused and he was court-martialed. He was subsequently found not guilty, and he left the service not long after, suffering from bone chips in his ankle from his college playing days. Holmes and his fellow black tankers shipped out for Europe, the 761st Tank Battalion. They were quickly in the thick of battle in the final drive across Europe toward the heart of Germany. They were in combat 183 straight days, including the worst of the Battle of the Bulge, the ferocious fight through the winter of 1944-1945 in the forests of Belgium. They were praised by General Patton and the other commanders of the infantry units they were supporting, but they could not fully escape the racial insults, not even there. Holmes remembers coming back from battles, their tanks battered and bloodied by the loss of their comrades, and hearing white soldiers tell Belgian villagers, "Those niggers ain't up there. They're just bringing the tanks up for the white boys to use." In fact, Holmes and the others in the 761st were face-to-face with death every day. One of Holmes' chilling memories is running through the woods on attack when he spotted a German sniper. He opened fire, killing the sniper immediately, realizing then and now that if he had not seen him just by chance, Holmes would have been shot in the back as he ran past. There was a widespread belief that black soldiers weren't up to the job. Dale Wilson, a retired Army major and now a military historian, said, "The African American was fighting a war on two fronts. He was fighting racism at home, Jim Crow, segregation, and he was fighting for the opportunity to fight. Here's a guy who has to beg to get into combat." General George S. Patton became a hero to the black tankers when he appeared before the 761st. Holmes thought he was the most dashing thing you ever saw, standing on a half-track with those two pearl-handled pistols. Patton said something to the effect, "You guys are a credit to your race. You're here because I asked for the best. Now go out there and kick some kraut ass." Yet there is also evidence that Patton had his private doubts about the ability of blacks to perform as well as whites in the military. Doubts about the fighting ability of the black soldiers were not confined to the American side. Holmes remembers vividly a conversation with a German prisoner of war, a Nazi major who had been born in Chicago before returning to the motherland. The major, stunned when he saw Holmes, a black man in uniform, said, "What are you doing here? This is a white man's war." Holmes and his buddies thought otherwise. They thought it was America's war. The record of the 761st was exemplary. Those black soldiers earned 8 silver stars, 62 bronze stars, and 296 purple hearts. One of the veterans of the 761st said more than 50 years later, "When you get over there and the nation's in trouble, you ain't got no black and white. You only got America." A simple and profound declaration from a man who, before he went into combat, trained at bases in American communities where the water fountains and the bathrooms said, "Whites only."